at the LHC, I mean, up there, all right? So this is, I think, going to be a change of tack, because you've had lots of looking at your schedule, lots of supersymmetry, lower energy, particle standard model, et cetera. And this is now observational cosmology, at least for the next hour and a half. Okay, and then there's going to be a hell of a lot more next week. So my name, as it says there, is Mike Hudson, and I'm a prof at UW, just a few minutes up the road. So I want to keep this very informal, especially since it's late in the day. If you have any questions, just interrupt and ask, and I'll try to answer as best I can in as much as time permits. Okay, so let me just give you the big picture as it's currently seen in what is becoming the standard model of cosmology today. And I'll try to explain a little bit about where some of the numbers on the side come from later on in the talk. Okay, so the pie diagram for the universe is a big chunk here, which goes under the name of dark energy. Okay, and I'm actually not going to say much about that. I'll say a little bit about it. You'll hear a little bit more about it later on next week, in particular from people who study high-redshift supernovae and use them as standard candles, as well as a variety of other techniques. Okay, so that's the big piece of the pie. There's another piece of the pie here, dark matter, and that's the focus of the bulk of this talk. But to understand this, we have to understand a little bit about the rest of this stuff. Okay, so aside from the neutrinos here, everything else is standard baryonic material in the periodic table. Okay, so I just want you to keep these numbers in mind so that they make sense when we go on and try to fit it into the context of some observables later on. The important thing is that the amount of baryons, which is mostly stars and gas floating out there in space between galaxies, is around 4 or 5%, according to the best estimates. Okay, the amount of dark matter is 25. Actually, I'd lower that to maybe 20 these days as a slightly better estimate, but with some uncertainty. And the remainder is dark energy, with only trace amounts of the other things. Okay, so where do those numbers come from? I'm going to try to give you a taste of where some of the numbers come from. So we need a little bit of convention. So how many people here have done some kind of cosmology course before? More than half. So most of you know about omega and the critical density. And those who don't, critical density is the density of matter or energy required in the universe to make the universe spatially flat. Okay, so it's a standard way of writing units of density as a ratio of the density of the stuff you're talking about to this critical density. And so in the context of what I just talked about, we think that the total density is the critical density. So omega in baryons would be 0.05, omega in dark matter around 0.2, 0.25, and omega in dark energy around 0.7. Okay, so if you see these subscripts, the B means baryons, M means matter, including the baryons, so dark matter and baryons, and the V is the vacuum or dark energy. The assumption through almost all this talk is that general relativity is valid on these scales. Okay, so most of my arguments would go out the window if we had a different theory of gravity. I'll try to give you some, if time permits, some reasons why we don't strongly believe in any of the alternatives that have arisen so far. Okay, so I'm going to give you, this is going to be a very broad brush. I'm going to try to go over a few of the lines of evidence, just very briefly and qualitatively in a hand-waving way, for dark matter. Okay, and so I've lumped those into two categories. This first group I call model independent, which means basically using our understanding of gravity to infer the presence of dark matter around some structure. And then there's some more complicated arguments, model dependent, which depends on the mix, the type of the dark matter, the amount of dark energy is more complicated cosmology. So I'll have to gloss over a lot of the details there, but hopefully you'll hear more about cosmic microwave backgrounds in particular next week, as well as large-scale structure from a couple of people who are going to talk about Sloan Digital Sky Survey and Lyman Alpha Forest. Okay. So the classic piece of evidence that people know about when they hear about dark matter, they learned about it in their undergraduate days, are galaxy rotation curves. Okay, so we have a nice spiral galaxy up here. So here's an image of the stars, okay, shown up here. In addition to the stars, we can also detect the neutral hydrogen gas from measuring the 21-centimeter line and the hyperfine splitting. So that's this map here. And you can see that the hydrogen gas extends beyond, in radius, beyond the stars. That's important. Okay. The redshift of that 21-centimeter line lets us measure the velocity of the gas. Okay. In this case, on a two-dimensional grid. Okay. So that's what's plotted down here in the lower left. So the blue means that those atoms are receding away from us relative to the center of the galaxy. And the red means coming towards us. So the interpretation of a map like this is that we're seeing something which would be more or less circular if we were looking from on top, you know, from up in the roof. Okay, but we're seeing it at an angle. And it's rotating in a disk. Okay, and because it's tilted, that means there's a component of the rotational velocity that's along the line of sight or towards us. Okay, and so this is a tilted rotating disk orbiting like this. And so if you look along, sorry, question? No, you can't measure that. It's too small. It's hard enough to measure this one. So if you look along the major axis here, okay, you can plot the velocities as a function of distance. Okay, so relative to the center of the system, they're away on one side and towards us on the other. Okay, so this represents a slice like this through this galaxy. Okay, now so far this is all straightforward. The important thing to notice about this is that the velocity as a function of distance from the center of the galaxy is flat out here. Okay? And it's flat at distances where there are not many stars. There's some gas, but not much stars, and not much mass. Okay? So that's important point number one. And this was discovered in the mid-70s by Vera Rubin and a number of other people. And it was generically found this is a different galaxy, but it's the same kind of curve folded over with both sides averaged together and flipped over. So you see the circular rotation velocity, kilometers per second, as a function of distance in astronomers' units of kiloparsecs. Okay? So the flatness of this here, if we have just simple particles orbiting around a mass, and we assume that that mass is spherical, which is a little caveat there, okay? Give me 2 seconds. Then you remember for a spherically symmetric system, remember the gravity from such a system only depends on the mass inside that radius. Okay? And it's the same as if you take all that mass and put it at the center of the object. Okay? So that's what this m less than r means. It means the mass contained within that radius. Alright? And then first year physics, right? With acceleration, well, there was an r there and there was an r squared there that got canceled, allows you to make this, write down this equation. Okay, yeah?
Just a silly question, how can you tell the glasses you should count out the angle? What's the measure of the angle?
Yeah, the angle of inclination, you mean? Yeah. Okay, so let's go back a sec. It's not a silly question. Basically, we can infer the angle of inclination from looking at the shape of the light under the assumption it's spherical. Sort of circular, seen face on, and which is almost true. Sorry? For our purposes here, it's good enough. Yeah. And secondly, we can look at the shapes of the isovelocity contours here as well. So with these two pieces of information, you get a reasonable inclination. You typically get it to a few degrees. Okay, so coming back to this equation, the important thing here is if we believe this is true, if we see flat rotation curve as a function of distance, in other words, V is constant, then that's telling us the mass within R is increasing linearly with R. Okay? And the important thing is that it increases continues to increase at distances beyond where most of the mass in the stars and the gas is. All right. So this is one of the pieces of evidence for dark matter. In other words, you have a picture like this where you have stars in the center, but even out here, the enclosed mass is still increasing. And it's approximately linearly with R. If you work out what that works out to density, it means the density of this stuff here, so-called dark matter halo, is falling off as 1 over R squared. Right? Because R squared dr in the integral gives you total mass length of R. Okay, so that's some old evidence for dark matter. Now, the problem with this is it only gives you a lower limit on the total mass, because eventually your hydrogen gives out. All right, as you can see in the previous picture, there's kind of a limit to where the hydrogen exists. It doesn't mean that the dark matter doesn't continue going further. Okay, it just means that there's a point where we can measure the rotation curve, and after that, we don't know if it's going to fall off, right, or keep going straight. So this gives some lower limit on the total mass, but not an upper limit. So this is useful for proving that there is dark matter in the universe, but it doesn't give you a useful number at the end of it. And there are other ways of getting at the number, which I'll talk about later if I have time. Okay, so another more useful toolbox for studying dark matter are clusters of galaxies. Okay, and the reason they're useful is you can attack clusters of galaxies using a number of different techniques. So those of you who haven't done much astronomy, what is a cluster of galaxies? A cluster of galaxies is essentially a big ball of galaxies. And these are the largest virialized objects in the universe. Okay, so they're assumed to be balls where the particles within the cluster are themselves galaxies. Okay, so the particles, the galaxies orbit through the center of the cluster, right, attracted by the overall gravity of the whole cluster, okay, which is stars, dark matter, and gas. Okay? And from the dynamics of those galaxies, primarily, originally just the virial theorem, you can infer what the mass of this structure is. Right? Because remember, the kinetic energy, which you can measure, if you measure the redshift of every galaxy, okay, you can get what the RMS kinetic energy, if you like, is compared to the mean recession velocity of the cluster. That gives you the kinetic energy, that's related to the potential energy, which is related to the total mass.
Your resolution of this call is 1 megaparsec?
So this is the scale of this picture is of order a megaparsec.
So by this, imagine a sphere, you mean what should be the radius of this sphere?
Yeah, so the radius from here to this corner is of order a megaparsec, right? Which is like 5 million light years, if that helps. Astronomers always use these crazy units, right? But a parsec is twiddle a light year, 3.26 light years in a parsec. Okay, so this is a big ball of dark matter, galaxies, and gas, which has a scale roughly of order of a megaparsec, 5 million light years. Now, in fact, it doesn't, like the galaxy halos, we don't know if it has a sharp edge. So that's just a rough scale, right? And probably the density tapers off as a function of distance. It has no well-defined edge. Okay, but the scale is to be contrasted with the previous case, where here we were only at 20 parsecs. Okay, so we've already gone up a factor of 50 in scale, roughly. That's one of the important things. Now, clusters of galaxies are useful because you can measure, as I said, their masses through dynamics. They're also, this is an optical picture. I unfortunately didn't manage to grab an X-ray picture in time. But if you look at them in X-rays, they emit very strongly in the X-rays because they're very deep potential wells. Okay, and the characteristic velocities through these potential wells are high, and hence the characteristic energies are high, so high that all the hydrogen gas is ionized. So it's a plasma. Okay, and that plasma emits X-ray radiation through what's called Bremsstrahlen radiation, right, which is just the acceleration of the electrons with respect to the other electrons and protons in the plasma. Okay, so they shine in X-rays, and that's very useful, as we'll see in a second. The third tool you can use to learn about clusters is gravitational lensing, which I'll spend a little bit of time on in the middle of this talk. But you can already see some lensing in this cluster. Okay, so these things that are labeled A, B, C, D, and E are multiple images of the same background galaxy. Okay, so there's an optical mirage effect caused by the bending of light due to the mass, right, that generates these multiple images. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So the red things are galaxies. These are the atoms, if you like, in this ball of particles. And this blue thing is a very distant background galaxy. Well, you can never be absolutely sure, because you can't fly out there and check them out. But there are some consistency tests that let me come back to it later, okay, because I'm going to show you a more detailed picture of this. So let's talk a little bit first about cluster dynamics, which I mentioned briefly. The virial theorem, or Jean's equations, for sort of hydrostatic equilibrium for a particle, a sea of particles in their mutual gravity, you can use to, if you could measure the velocities and make some assumption about the orbits, which are not that severe, you can use these to invert them and determine the masses of clusters. And actually, Zwicky did this in 1937, which is pretty amazing. So here's an excerpt from one of his papers. Okay, so he looked at the Coma cluster, which is not the one that you just saw. And in those days, they weren't sure that galaxies were even, well, he was sure, but in the community as a whole, they weren't sure that galaxies were even outside our own galaxy. They thought they could be clouds within our galaxy. So at that time, they were called nebulae. So where he says nebulae here, we would translate that as galaxies today. Okay, so from the argument that I made, which is, you don't see it here, but it's this virial theorem argument, he deduces the mass of the entire cluster and says, well, there's 1,000 galaxies in there, so the average mass of one galaxy is about this much. Okay? 4 times 10 to the 10 solar masses. Alright? Now he knows what the average luminosity of a typical galaxy is in units of the sun's luminosity. Okay? So he can divide these two numbers and get what's called a mass to light ratio. Okay? Which, by definition, if it's all in solar units, is 1 for the sun. For a standard mixture of stars in a typical galaxy, it might be a little bit more than 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, something like that. Okay? But he comes up with a number of 500. Okay? Compared to the value of 3 measured locally within our galaxy. So even in 1937, Zwicky knew that the Coma cluster was filled with a hell of a lot of matter that was not stars. Right, by roughly a factor of 100. A little bit of an overestimate. We wouldn't say so much today. But it's not that far off. So Zwicky knew about this, but everybody ignored Zwicky because he was a bit of a crank, as you see there. crank, but he was right. There's another way you can get at the mass, and that's through this X-ray emission that I talked about. So if you measure the temperature of the cluster, of the X-ray emitting gas, and if, for whatever reason, historical experimental reasons, temperatures of clusters are expressed in KeV. Okay, so hotter temperature means deeper potential wealth, means a more massive cluster. All right. If you know the temperature, you count how many photons you're emitting, you can figure out how much gas there is. Okay, so from the X-ray observations, you can directly detect how many atoms of hydrogen there are. Okay, from the temperature and how the temperature changes as a function of radius, the temperature is what's the best way to put it? The temperature is related to the pressure. Okay, remember the ideal gas law. Okay, and from the gradient in the pressure, how that pressure changes as a function of depth from the center of the cluster outwards, you can solve for the mass, knowing that the change in pressure has to balance the gravity, right? The same way the pressure goes down when you go down in the ocean from the weight of the stuff above you. So exactly the same thing happens in clusters. So X-ray observations allow you to simultaneously measure the total gravitating mass of the cluster, okay, as well as the amount of hydrogen gas there is. And you can make a correction for how much helium you think there is, because that ratio is pretty well known. And so what's plotted here on this vertical axis And the amount of stars is pretty negligible, actually, compared to the amount of hydrogen gas. So most of the baryonic material in the cluster, by a factor of roughly 7 to 10, is hydrogen helium gas in an ionized plasma. Okay, and the amount of stars is pretty small. Okay, so to a good approximation, the gas mass tells you the total amount of baryons, normal stuff there is, which is mostly hydrogen helium. Small amounts, trace amounts of heavier things, like iron. Meanwhile, the X-ray observations from the pressure gradients also give you the total mass. And so if you ratio the two, you find that, and this is a recent paper from a colleague of mine up at UW, you find that the ratio of those two things is not one. Okay? So the gravitating mass, the ratio of the two, is maybe, let's say, around 0.12, I think it's the number that shows here. So there's seven times as much matter in total than there is in gas. And there's only a trace amount of stars. Okay, the stars themselves are maybe a factor of 10 times down on the gas. So Zwicky's factor of 100 for the stars wasn't actually that far off. Okay. Now this is a little bit of conflict with what we get from cosmology, which I'll come back to later. It's the number up here. The important thing is that this is nowhere near one. Okay? So that's the important point. Now, there's a few caveats. It seems to be lower here for these shallower potential wells. And that could be because some of the gas has escaped from the cluster potential. But for the deepest clusters, it appears to plateau. So it's far from one. That's the important point that you should understand. All right. Hello. Why are we stuck? All right, so let me go on to the third technique, gravitational lensing, which I'll spend a little bit of time on. This is the cartoon version, and it's pretty much all you need for understanding qualitatively how it behaves. Okay, so let's say we have a background star, okay, which, if there was nothing there, would shine like directly towards us, okay, the observer down here. Okay, now, in the presence of a mass, here, GR tells us that that light beam will be deflected. Okay? And how much is it deflected? Well, it's deflected by that much. Okay, so here's what happens. The light beam comes, passes the mass. In general, we assume this is very small. The scale of this object is small compared to the distance here. Because this might be at most a megaparsec if it was a cluster, and this distance is here a gigaparsec. Okay, so functionally we treat this as a plane, although it's not shown that way here. So this photon, which would have missed us, is deflected into our line of sight. Okay, but we see its apparent position as if it were here. Okay, so there's a bending angle through which the photon is deflected. All right, and that bending angle, alpha, here, just depends on the mass of the thing doing the bending. This impact parameter, the distance from the center of the mass to where the photon's ray was, and some other constants. Okay, so it's very straightforward. And this number here is the factor, this 4 is what you get out of general relativity. 2 is what you calculate if you think about orbits passing the sun, and you take a particle and you throw it at the speed of light. So that would be the Newtonian way of calculating the bending angle. Right? You remember from classical mechanics, you have unbound orbits, they travel on hyperbole, and you, from the impact parameter and the velocity, you can figure out what the bending angle is. And so in simple Newtonian gravity with a particle moving at the speed of light, you get a factor of 2 here. General relativity gives you a factor of 4. And it was the observation of this deflection where this black thing was the sun in 1919, which was one of the confirmations of general relativity. When they looked at during an eclipse, they saw the positions of stars that would normally have been there were shifted. And they were shifted by an amount which is more consistent with the 4 than with the 2. Yeah?
has effect that we also explain because of the radiative refraction coefficient around this stuff. It's excluded.
Yes. Yeah.
So the density cannot be enough.
Yes, that's right. That's right. You see this everywhere, far, far away from where there's any stellar material. Okay. Okay, so that's how it works. And the important thing is, qualitatively, is that the strength of this effect depends on the mass, right? Okay, so we can use it, if we can measure it, how much bending there is, we can use that to figure out what the mass is. Now, the problem is that the bending angle cosmologically is not usually observable. Okay, so a distant galaxy is over here, and it gets bent by some amount, but the problem is we don't know where it was originally, so we can't actually measure the bending angle. You can only measure the bending angle in nearby systems like an eclipse, where the sun is moving across the path of the background star field. Right, but at cosmological distances, nothing moves. Effectively, it's a frozen snapshot. Okay, so we can't actually measure the bending angle, but luckily there are ways to get around it. Okay, so this is an animation of what would happen if you had a massive object. Okay, and we imagine this is some perfect wallpaper that God painted down, full of circles, and we furthermore, just for visual purposes, allow that wallpaper to move. Okay, so we can see how the image of a particular object is distorted at different positions relative to the mass. And this is actually a somewhat more complicated mass. There's a big mass here and a little one here. Okay. So the important thing in looking at this diagram is there's two regimes, okay, called strong lensing and weak lensing. Strong lensing is where it's in this region here, where a single object, like that one that you just saw go through, can be turned into multiple images. Okay? It's highly distorted into these big arcs. Alright? Weak lensing is this effect over here, where you just observe that these objects here are not circles. Okay? They're small ellipses. Alright? And the sense of the ellipse is that the orientation of the major axis of the ellipse is tangential to the center of this mass. Okay? So there's a whole ream of mathematics here, which I'm skipping, and I'm hoping one of the other speakers will cover it later. Basically, starting from this simple equation here, you can work out the sum of the bending angle from a whole series of point masses, okay? And the shapes of these background objects here are given by some derivatives of those bending angles. And let's just give you a flavor for it. So strong lensing in the middle, weak lensing at the edges. Okay, so how do we use this? Well, you might think, well, galaxies aren't round, right? The one I showed you when we talked about the rotation curve was a spiral galaxy, which would be round if it was seen edge on, face on, I mean, but it's tilted, so it looks like an ellipse itself. Okay, so you can't use an individual galaxy to measure this effect. But the assumption is that if I have a whole number of galaxies in some region of space, that they should have no preferred direction. Okay, so an individual galaxy may be tilted one way, another one tilted another way, another one tilted some third way. And there should be no reason why all the galaxies in given space would all be tilted in the same sense. Okay, so if we measure the shapes of a number of galaxies, and we average them, we can see if there's a statistical tendency for them to be aligned in one way. Okay, and that's the basis of how weak lensing works. I'm going to come back to that in a second. Okay, so Zwicky, again, the difficult personality, as it says here, he called his colleagues at Caltech, who are smart people, spherical bastards, because everywhere you look at them, they are still bastards. So you can see why with this kind of personality, maybe some of his ideas didn't catch on as quickly as they should have. But he was a very smart guy. And I showed you the other paper, which was written about the same time. He'd done that work on the coma cluster. So he knew that galaxies had dark matter. And even in the 30s, he knew also about gravitational lensing. Now, Einstein had worked out gravitational lensing effect, of course, to check general relativity, the deflection of light around the sun. And in the early 30s, he wrote a paper about the deflection of light from distant stars by nearby stars. Okay, and he worked it out, and he found that that deflection angle, that alpha that you saw in the previous formula, was very small, microarcseconds. Okay, so it could never be resolved from the ground. So he wrote this short paper saying this is this, but the masses are too small, this effect will never be measured for these distant stars, because the bending angle is too tiny. But Zwicky knew about dark matter. Okay, and so he realized that even if the effect couldn't be detected for individual stars, okay, it could still be detected for galaxies. It was quite amazing. He put it together his knowledge of the coma cluster with lensing and realized that you could put these two things together. All right. So he says the discovery of images of nebulae, meaning multiple images, would be of interest, right? For one thing, it gives you another test of general relativity. Secondly, it lets you see nebulae at distance greater than those from ordinary telescopes, because we look at some of these at some locations. If I can pause this. Some of these objects are highly magnified. Okay, it's in certain configurations and certain orientations, you can get large magnification. That can let you see intrinsically faint things. They're blown up using the gravitational lens itself as an extra magnifier. So Zwicky was aware of that, and that's what he meant by the second line. And finally, he says, observations of this may provide the most direct determination of nebular masses, by which he meant the dark matter problem, which nobody else was worrying about. Pretty cool. Okay, so here's a better example of, it's the same example, but it allows you to see a little bit more detail. Now, here is the image that we saw before, where they're no longer labeled here. Okay, and here's a model of if you take some mass distributed around these points and you posit a certain original galaxy shape, which is, I think, this one. So it's sort of, you can't really see the cross piece here. But this looks like originally this galaxy would have looked roughly like a Greek theta symbol. Okay? And so you can do the ray tracing in the computer if you have a good mass model. Right? For every point on the original galaxy, you can shoot it through the cluster and see where it winds up. Okay, and so that's what this model does. So this is a model which tries to reproduce these observations here. And the model is pretty good. It reproduces more or less the morphology of these things, particularly this long one is matched with this one here, this little one here, this one here, this that one there, and so on. Okay, and there's a very faint fit image down here. Okay, so this cluster is at a redshift of 0.4. Okay, and this blue thing is behind it at a redshift of 0.7, roughly twice as far away.
Where is the original galaxy?
I think it's supposed to be this thing. It's a model of it.
Can each of you these are the images by measuring the correlation functions?
The best way, and I can't remember if in this particular cluster they've done this, but in general the best way to check if two images are the same thing, if they're bright enough, is to measure the redshifts. Okay, because gravitational lensing will not affect the energy of any of the photons, so the spectrum of the two will be identical. Okay, whereas two random galaxies, they could have redshifts anywhere from 0 to 3 or something like that. So if you see two images which agree with your model and which have the redshift, you can be pretty confident that they are what they are.
But can this be altered by the effect of interference? You have plus a one image.
No, the interference, you mean sort of like actually interference of waves. No, that doesn't affect you on this scale. There are some micro lenses which people postulate you could have interference effects, but this is all macroscopic, so there's no interference of that nature. In fact, when I said the redshifts are, they should appear identical, there's a little caveat. There's actually a time delay between different images. Right? So the light will take different times to travel through the different paths. Right? One is a geometric effect, how far it actually has to go. And then there's time dilation as well, as it goes through the center of the gravitational potential well. Okay, so although we see images of the same objects, they're not at the same time. And that can actually be used as an important tool itself. That's another story. Okay, so that's how strong lensing works. And the point with respect to dark matter is that you have to build a mass model to reproduce these images. And essentially, the more mass you put in here, the farther apart these images are going to get. And you can see that back here, there's a magic radius, although this is not the perfect circle, there's a magical radius here, right, which separates the strong and weak lensing regime. And it's at that radius where you get this very strongly distorted arcs. That's called the Einstein radius. Okay, and the scale of the Einstein radius depends on the mass. Yep?
What is the relationship between the first gravitation curve and this galaxy gravitational lensing technique? What is the relationship between them?
Well, the problem with the rotation curves, as I said originally, is we only get a lower limit on the mass. Okay, so the masses that you get from the clusters are bigger than the masses that you get from the spiral galaxies. Okay, but the spiral galaxies are just a lower limit. All right. So Zwicky knew what he was doing. Now, weak lensing is ultimately the more powerful technique. Here's again the same cluster. You can just see those little things there, maybe rotated a little bit. Now these sticks here show you the mean orientation, the so-called polarization sticks, show you the mean orientation of a number, hundreds, of very, very faint galaxies that you can't see in this image, okay, but the computer can detect and measure the shape of, right, and it averages the shape, and there's a scaling between the length of the stick, how distorted it is, and the orientation stick tells you the orientation of the average shapes of galaxies. And it's been smoothed and massaged a little bit so that it looks less noisy than it would in reality. Okay? So from this polarization map that you can get from the real data, there's a very clever inversion technique invented by Nick Kaiser, which allows you to go from this with some mathematical manipulation to a map of the density. Okay, so remember, this is the total gravitating density that's shown by these contours. Okay, so it's measuring everything that's causing like the bend, dark matter, gas, whatever. Okay, and the nice thing is that where you have an excess of galaxies, you have an excess of matter. Okay, but you get more matter than you would calculate just based on the stars and gas alone. Okay, so you can convert. There are no units on here, but you can convert these contours into real numbers, into number of solar masses. Okay, so that's the third line of evidence, if you like. And I think James Taylor is going to talk a little bit more about this. Okay, so for some clusters that are at the right distance, you can apply both techniques, the X-ray technique and the lensing technique, as well as the dynamics, which I haven't shown you, and compare and see how they agree. Okay, so this is for such a sample. These funny zip codes are the names of the clusters. Okay, what's plotted on the vertical axis is the ratio of the lensing mass to the X-ray mass. Okay, as a function of the mass of the cluster. And so these authors argue that, okay, first of all, the error bars are large, right? But overall, they're consistent in the sense that most of the error bars go through this line of 1. Okay, so there's no obvious discrepancy between lensing masses and X-ray masses. And they both indicate substantially more matter than there is in the gas and the stars. Okay, by completely different methods. Right, this is weak lensing, so it's using these little sticks and these sorts of maps. Having created one of these maps, you can say how much mass is within a given annuli, for example. Okay, now, this is just an aside, mainly because it's a bit of my own work. You can also do this around galaxies. Okay, so what our hope is that we can, and this is still work in progress, is that we can apply the same weak lensing technique around clusters of galaxies big balls of galaxies to individual galaxies. Okay, but it hasn't been done yet. But when we do it, which will happen soon because the data is getting better and better, we'll be able to measure the total masses of galaxies, that's the hope, and compare them with the rotation curve stuff that I talked about right at the beginning. And so you get to see if there's consistency. Yeah?
When you're talking about the matter in a galaxy, you mean the matter in the sun, in the stars in that?
No, I mean any matter that gravitates. So stars, gas if there is any, and dark matter. Right? So all these methods that I've talked about, like gravitational lensing or rotation curves, are sensitive to any matter that gravitates. That's the important point. Right? So any matter that gravitates will cause these effects. So we can infer the total mass. From such techniques.
Okay, so for example, in our solar system, most of the mass belongs to sun.
Yes.
So is there any possibility that the dark matter is because of some planet in those galaxies?
Well, I'll come back to that right at the end. The short answer is no, but it's the route to that is not entirely obvious, okay? So let me come back to that later. Okay, so to recap, spiral galaxies measure things on scales of tens of parsecs, tens of kiloparsecs. Cluster is 1 megaparsec or so. And there's also methods that you can use to measure the dark matter distribution on larger scales. Okay? And one of these is peculiar velocities. Okay, so peculiar velocities are what it says here. They're deviations from the universe's uniform expansion. Okay, so if the universe were completely homogeneous, it would expand uniformly everywhere. But it's not homogeneous. For one thing, there are clusters and galaxies in it. And there are structures on even larger scales, superclusters, which are some small multiple of the average density. So where there's more gravitating matter than average, the expansion locally is slower than global average. And the reverse, of course, is also true. Under dense regions where there are no galaxies, the expansion there is faster. Okay, so if you can measure this local expansion rate, you can, again, invert it and figure out how much mass there is. And this would take a full lecture to explain properly, so I'm going to skip all that and just show you the pictures. Okay, so now the scale has changed again. Now we have hundreds of megaparsecs. Okay, so a cluster of galaxies that we saw previously is about as big as the red dot on this laser pointer. All right, this is a scale up by a factor of 100, two orders of magnitude. And the map that you see on the left is what you get if you measure these peculiar velocities and you use a method to invert those and deduce what the density of matter is. Okay, and so generally you have this in a three-dimensional volume, and this is a slice through such a volume. So it's a two-dimensional cross-section. It happens to be a particular plane where there's a lot of interesting structure. Okay, so in these units, we live right here in the center in a slightly under-dense region, according to this map. But we would, from the peculiar velocities alone, we would deduce that there's a large concentration of mass over here. This thing's called the Great Attractor. That's what GA stands for. Which is about 50 megaparsecs away. There's another one a little bit farther, about 60 megaparsecs away in the constellation of Perseus. PP is Perseus Pisces. And there's an even larger thing further away called the Shapley concentration, which is identified by Shapley and Perseus. These have all been identified after the fact by looking, well, not after the fact, but independently by looking at the light. Okay, so the map that's on the right is what happens if you just count galaxies. You put them in 3D, which you know because the universe is expanding roughly according to Hubble's expansion, and you can make some small corrections with peculiar velocity. So you can build a three-dimensional map of the density of galaxies, smooth that, and slice it the same way. Okay? Now that smoothing is a little bit different. I think this is a 5 megaparsec smoothing. This is a 12 megaparsec smoothing. That's why this looks smoother. And the contours aren't exactly the same. But the reassuring thing is that the lumps that you see are more or less in the same place. In other words, you see a big lump over here, a big lump over here, and another big lump up here. And you don't see as many obvious lumps. Where you see dashed lines here, that means the density is below the average. Okay? And the little arrows you see there are the peculiar velocity fields that's generated by this matter, by the matter distribution if the matter followed the light. Okay, so that's a predicted peculiar velocity field. Okay, so the extent to which these two maps disagree or agree tells you how well light on large scales is related to mass. Okay, and to first order, there's a correspondence. Right, so where there are galaxies, there are there's mass. If there's not huge amounts of dark matter hiding in the voids, for example, where there are no galaxies. And furthermore, again, as with the lensing, we can figure out exactly how much matter there is here, okay, and add it up and work out what the omega matter is. Okay, so that number comes out to be around 0.3. Okay, and that's the total matter content. All right. So, yeah, yep.
But the pen doesn't tell you anything about kind of some
cold
gas or whatever.
Nope, it doesn't. So I'm going to come back to that right at the end. But I can give you the detailed arguments. Why don't I say it now since it's come up twice? I have it in my FAQ list. It tells us the total matter content. That's exactly right. It doesn't tell us what it is. However, we know from observations, two independent observations. One has to do with the amplitude of the angular power spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. Okay, that has a certain shape, and its specific shape, and you're going to hear a lot about this next week, I'm imagining. Okay, so in the cosmic microwave background, basically what happens, to try to condense it in 5 minutes or less, is that you have fluctuations, okay, and the fluid of photons has pressure, because the photons have pressure. So those fluctuations on certain scales can oscillate. Okay? And so there are sound waves effectively in the CMB. And there's characteristics, there's a velocity associated with those sound waves, which is the speed of light divided by root 3, roughly. Okay? And so, and there's a time scale associated with the CMB, which is the time from the Big Bang to the time that you see it. And so there's a physical scale, which is that sound speed times that time, okay, and putting it very crudely. And so there are characteristic scales on which these sounds, these oscillations can go through a half a phase, a full phase, or many phases. And they give you, you may have seen plots of the angular power spectrum of CMB, which has all these bumps and wiggles in it. So from the detailed physics of these bumps, and it gets more complicated when you have a certain amount of baryons like hydrogen and helium, will affect the dynamics of these sound waves because they're coupled to the photons. Okay, and so from the CMB observations, which are now incredibly precise, you can determine exactly how many baryons there are. Okay, and the number, the omega of baryons that you get in the same units as this is 0.05. Okay, so that's an independent measurement of the total density of baryons. And the important point is that it disagrees with this, right, by a factor of around 6 to 7, okay, which is exactly the same ratio as what you see in clusters of galaxies when you compare the gas plus star mass to the total mass. Okay, so we have a limit on the total number of baryons, and so planets and bricks and Jupiters and black holes, if they're formed from exploded stars and are not made primordial, all have to be made of baryons. So that argument sets an upper limit on the amount of baryons that you can have. Okay. Now there's another independent argument, which comes from the abundance of the different elements, particularly how much hydrogen to helium there is, right, and deuterium, and so on. And so if you do nucleosynthesis in the early universe, and you cook up the elements as the universe expands and cools. So it's actually a simple system, relatively simple to calculate. You can work out, depending on the density of, if you start off with all neutrons and protons, what abundance of different elements you get. Okay, and that depends on the density of the overall amount of neutrons plus protons that you start with, because the reaction rate scale with the densities. of those things. Okay, so the final ratios of hydrogen to helium to deuterium and all the way down to lithium, which are all created primordially, although lithium is very trace, lets you measure the density through an independent method. Okay, and that method agrees more or less with the CNB method. Okay, they both give numbers 0.04, 0.05, something like that, which are quite far from here. I was going to say that at the end, but so I'll save me the point later. Okay. And they also agree with the, as I just mentioned, with these numbers in clusters. Right? This ratio that you see here, way back, a lot of clicks, this one. There. Right, it's 0.12-ish. Okay, so the picture actually hangs together quite surprisingly well from very independent methods with very different physics and very different observations. So the cosmology is in a very different state from what it used to be 10 years ago because the independent observations all point in the same direction. All right. Okay, so peculiar velocities again give you a large amount of matter. And so these peculiar velocity measurements are consistent with the cluster measurements, more or less, in terms of the amount of dark matter you expect. Okay, now here, so I'm going to we're running out of time anyway. I'm going to hand wave through this part because it'll be covered a hell of a lot more later on. I just want to summarize the big picture. There's another independent way of determining the cosmological parameters, the matter density, the baryon density, and the total density through the curvature of the universe, and that depends on a combination of two things. And one of them is these cosmic microwave background fluctuations that I discussed. And the other one is the spectrum of fluctuations in maps that you see. So in other words, if I had a map like this one that I showed you, it was a lot bigger, okay, in three dimensions, I could fit this with a bunch of waves, in other words, Fourier transform it, and look at the spectrum of fluctuations of different scales. Okay, so let's just mention the CMB for a few minutes first. I imagine most of you have seen a little bit of this. The cosmic microwave background is this leftover fog, right? When the universe was small and dense, it was hot, and all the hydrogen was ionized. And then as it expanded and cooled, the hydrogen recombined, but that's always the wrong word because it started off ionized. Right? Normally you think in the lab you start with neutral hydrogen, you ionize it, and then it recombines. But in this case, the universe began ionized. So recombination is the wrong word. It should be called combination, but anyway. The universe becomes neutral, okay? And the difference as far as the photons are concerned is that when the universe is ionized, they're scattering. And the universe becomes neutral, all of a sudden it's transparent. Okay, so we see a map back. Those photons then leave the CMB and move directly towards us. And so when we look at the cosmic microwave background, we're seeing a map of the temperature at that very early time when the universe went from ionized to neutral. Okay, and the first order, as most of you know, is a nice black body spectrum with a temperature around 2.73 Kelvin. Okay, nice black body because of all the scattering that those photons did. All right, there's a big dipole in it. So this is what happens if you subtract off this mean. All right, and you get a big dipole in it. And the dipole comes because, let me go back for a few slides, because with respect to all the matter in the universe, you'll notice that our cells at the origin here don't have a zero velocity. We have a peculiar velocity. Because we're close to some big masses, which are retarding the expansion locally, and as a result of that peculiar velocity, we're not at rest with respect to this bath of photons coming from the very distant universe. All right. So that's what gives us this dipole pattern. You subtract that off, okay, and you get a band across the center, which is not primordial CMB. This is emission from the plane of our galaxy. Okay, so the coordinates here are chosen so the plane of our galaxy cuts through the middle. So we should ignore this part. It's bright red. Okay, but these are COBE maps from the early 90s. These ripples that you see here, these hot spots and cold spots, are gravitational wells at this very early time. Okay, and they're very small, like microkelvins, because the ripples in the early universe were also very small. It's almost perfectly homogeneous with these tiny little ripples. Right, it's the same tiny ripples that were seen at that early time, which are now these big structures that you saw in the previous maps. Okay, because anything that's, you know, a clump of dark matter is unstable, right? If it has an excess of matter, it's going to retard the expansion, attract particles to it relative to the average, and that will increase its density and it will attract more. Right? So fluctuations in matter are unstable. They continue to grow. Right? So these tiny little ripples in early time grow to be structure that we see today. That's the standard picture. Now, where these ripples come from is another, what generates them before that, that's a problem that is yet unsolved. The leading model for where these ripples come from are quantum fluctuations generated during deflation. Okay, and then the physics of how a given scale will grow as a function of time, it turns out, you know, although most of the fluctuations are unstable, how unstable they are depends on whether the universe is mostly, whether its energy density is mostly dominated by radiation or matter. And so there's a complicated bit of physics, which usually takes me most of a graduate course to do properly, which will allow you to propagate the amplitude of a primordial fluctuation right down to the present day. Okay? But the important thing is that that propagation encodes some cosmological parameters. Okay, so how a given wave grows will depend on how much dark matter there is, how much dark energy, how much radiation, and so on. So that's the, qualitatively, that's the important thing to know.
Is there any reason for the asymmetry on the left, right? You have more green on the left and more blue on the right.
No, I don't know if there's any reason for that. I wouldn't believe this part. The question is up here, maybe. Have a look at the next map, which is perhaps a little bit better. Okay, so this is more recent data from WMAP 2003. Now we've got a slightly better map still, but much finer resolution. Okay, the other one was COBE 92. That's the, you know, this is the one that just won the Nobel Prize, right? And this one, well, it's too early to give a Nobel Prize for something that's only so recent. Okay. But COBE was more important because it showed the fluctuations. Before that, nobody knew the fluctuations existed. So it was a very fundamental measurement. They knew about this thing, right, which has an amplitude of 3 millikelvin. They knew about the dipole, but they didn't know about these tiny little ripples, which are many orders of magnitude smaller. Okay. So it's a big technological leap to go from here to here. So this is a fairly recent map of the CMB. They've tried to subtract out the plane of the galaxy. It's probably not perfect. And I'm sure you'll be seeing versions, a lot more versions of this next week. So let me go on beyond there, aside from the nice beauty picture. Let me talk about large-scale structure for a few minutes. Okay, so you saw the map I showed you before with the peculiar velocities and the distribution of light. Okay, so that had a scale, I think it went up to plus or minus 100 megaparsecs, so it was a little square in the center in terms of scale. This is distribution of galaxies on a larger scale still from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. There's two main surveys of Sloan, and there's another one in an Australian English thing called 2DF. They both mapped out the distribution of galaxies in very large volumes. So what you're seeing here is kind of like a disk. In other words, if we imagine a strip on the sky, okay, we can identify the galaxies where they are in angular units, okay, and then the redshift gives us the third coordinate, the radial coordinate. Okay, so then you can look down on top of it and plot the radius here. And the strip is very thin, you don't worry about the vertical part. Okay, so there's more data on this side than on this side, that's why the side looks quite sparse. But you can see that from a gross perspective, you know, if you're way in the back of the room and you kind of blur your eyes a bit, well, let's just look at this slide. It's more or less the same color of blue across. But if you zoom in a little bit more, you see that it's not perfectly uniform. There's structures in here, okay, which are, you know, just by eye, about 100 megaparsecs in size. Okay. So there are characteristic scales in the universe, and but the largest one where you can measure a deviation from homogeneity is around 100 megaparsecs or so. And you can see that with these walls and underdense regions here where there's less galaxies than average. Okay, the different colors are different if you go to fainter and fainter galaxies, which is easier to do nearby. Okay, so these structures here that you see on this scale at about 100, 150 megaparsecs correspond to a degree spot in the cosmic microwave background. Okay, so that's the mapping from that angular scale to the physical scale today. Okay, so you can quantify all of this. And this tries to put a lot of information onto the same plot. Okay, so if we do what I said earlier, which is to Fourier transform a map like this one, okay? So if I have a 3D version of this, I can Fourier transform it, measure a power spectrum, okay? Or equivalently, I can use another statistic, which is to take a circle of a given size, okay? Let's imagine my circle is 100 megaparsecs, measure the mean density within a sphere of that radius, okay? And then move it to another location and measure the mean density there, okay? And then get an average, which is the universal average density, but measure the root mean square around that density. Okay, and I can do that for spheres of different sizes. Okay, so you can see the first order, if I take a very large sphere, well, I'm going to get some average density here. It's not going to be very different from some average density here. Okay, but if I take a very small sphere, I might get an empty patch, or I might get one of these dense clusters. Okay, so qualitatively, you can see that smaller sphere will get a larger fluctuation around the mean than a larger one. Okay, and so that's sort of what's encoded in this plot. These are measures of the density fluctuations within spheres compared to the mean density. Okay, so this SDSS survey that we're looking at are these black dots. Okay, so on the largest scales, now millions of light years, the fluctuations around the mean are perhaps a little bit less than 10%. The largest scales they can measure. They run out of room because they can't put, you know, once they get to the size of the survey, you can only put one sphere in there and you can't measure an RMS of only one. On smaller scales, you can get many smaller scales. So when smaller spheres, so when you get down to scales of around 100 million light years or so, you have fluctuations which are roughly 100%. Okay? So that's another way of encoding this information about how clustered the universe is on different scales. And there's a number of tools you can use to do this. The cosmic microwave background, you can, if you know the conversion from angular scales to physical scales, you can plot those. Those are the red points. This Sloan data points are these points that you've just shown. You can use gravitational lensing, although really only on a small range of scales at the moment, which is shown up here, although we're in the process of trying to extend that, to measure how much the mass fluctuates from those maps that I showed you before. So you can play the same game on those maps. You have to make some, do some tricks to account for projection, like you're seeing them in 2D, not 3D, etc. And then I think you're going to have a whole lecture on this one, which is called the line alpha forest. And those are fluctuations in neutral hydrogen and high redshift. There's a number of different techniques that you can use to probe these fluctuations on different scales. And although I haven't told you of any of the physics of it, take my word for it that the shape of this blue curve is dependent on the cosmological parameters. Okay, so in particular, the slope of it on large scales is closely related to the primordial spectrum that comes out of inflation. Okay, so this cosmic microwave background is good for measuring that. This bend here, okay, has to do with the precise location of this, where it rolls over from this slope to this slope, has to do with at what epoch the universe went from having its energy density dominated by matter to its energy density dominated by radiation. Okay, so the energy, if you have a given number of photons in a box, as the universe expands, those photons are redshifting. Okay, so the number density of photons is falling as, you know, the length scale cubed. Okay, but the energy of those photons is falling again by that same factor. So So the energy density of photons falls as expansion factor of the universe to the minus 4, okay? Whereas the energy density of matter, since it's just a number of particles and their energy doesn't change, so they're not redshifting, only falls to the minus 3. Okay, so in the early phases of the universe is dominated by radiation. The radiation energy density drops faster than the matter density. And where that crossover happens depends on the density of matter today, right? Something we would like to know. And you can read it off by where this curves. Okay, so without going into more detail than that about the background, the important thing to notice is that there's cosmological information in the shape of this. Okay, and also in the detailed shape of the fluctuations in the CMB, how much, if you can do the analog of this in the CMB, which is to not Fourier transform it, but to transform it in YLMs, right, in spherical harmonics, and measure what RMS you get for the coefficients of each of those YLMs. In particular, how much, if you average over all the M's at a given L, what you get. And that's also encoded with the more complicated physics of the CMB, these sound waves I talked about before. So you put these two things together, and yet there's a wealth of cosmological information, which is somewhat model-dependent, because it's dependent on this picture of cool dark matter plus dark energy plus a certain number of baryons. So if any of those assumptions are wrong, you'd have to revisit the conclusions that you drew from it. Okay, so as I said, skip many, many, many years of hard theoretical and observational work, and this is what you get out of large-scale structure and the cosmic microwave background only. Okay, so this is a plane of parameter space where we've got the matter density, omega matter, okay, and dark energy density on this, all in these omega units, all divided by the critical density, going from 0 to 1 in each case. Okay, and if the sum of the two is 1, then the universe is flat. Okay, which is shown by this line here. Okay, these are taken from Max Tegmark's website. So WMAP, from looking at the angular scale of those fluctuations and knowing what physical scale they correspond to, turns out does a very good job of measuring the sum of these two components. And from that data, we know more or less the universe is flat. Okay, so it's spatially flat, which is this, it's certainly consistent with that, okay, which is this dotted line. Okay, so all this region of parameter space that's red is ruled out by the first year of WMAP data. The second year of data, the second release, the third year of data, trimmed that down a little bit more, but did allow you to have some universes where the total sum of dark energy and matter was greater than 1, which, if those of you who've taken cosmology course, remember that corresponds to a universe which is finite and closed. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Are there independent measurements for the flatness of the universe?
There are no independent measurements of this type for the flatness of the universe. There are indirect ways of getting at this and adding them together to deduce what the flatness is. Okay? So you'll hear later on next week that the supernovae will measure a combination in this plane. Okay, and another data set will measure some other combination in this plane. So if you believe both of those, and you're lucky enough that they cross, you can deduce both of them independently. Okay, so from what WMAP measures most exquisitely, aside from the baryon density, which I mentioned earlier, is this very thin banana. But you notice it's highly degenerate. You could be up here, or you could be down here. Right, you're close to flat. The shape of the spectrum here, through Sloan and other techniques, lets us really measure what omega matter is very accurately. Okay, so if we add in the Sloan, then this big long stripe becomes this much smaller banana. Still degenerate along this line, but not as degenerate as it was before. Okay? Oh yeah, if you care about that, yeah. That's right. If you care about whether it's negative or positive, so here's the actual number. Okay? This is the sum of these two things, and, you know, it's 0.01. Okay? So the errors maybe within the future, they're going to get better by a factor of 2, but they're never going to get any better than that. So we'll never be able to say conclusively, you know, unless this number turned out to be very large, much larger than this, but if it continues as 1, then, you know, all you can do is shrink the error bars. Okay? So that's the state of the art, and that's not going to get much better. Right? And the reason it's not going to get much better is that essentially WMAP has done that measurement as good as it's ever going to be. Okay? So that this banana, you know, this thin banana is not going to shrink much more that way. The only way we can get a handle on it is something else, which will tell us whether we're on this part or this part. Okay? So far we haven't used anything that I talked about in the beginning of this lecture. Nothing to do with clusters, nothing to do with gravitational lensing, nothing to do with rotation curves. Okay, so independently from these methods, the shape of this power spectrum and the CMB were reduced to this part of parameter space, okay, where the matter density is somewhere between 0.2 and 0.3. Right. And since the sum is 1, that means that the vacuum energy is somewhere between 0.8 and 0.7. Okay. Yeah.
The area rolled out by 3 steps.
Yep.
Assuming that the rolling out by WMAP.
Yes. So it's the extra ruling out once you
take
WMAP already and you add SDSS to it. If you just had SDSS by itself, it probably allows some band that's more vertical, like this. So it's the intersection of two different parameter space regions which intersect only in a smaller area. All right, so that's what I just said. Clusters, there's general agreement about the masses from different methods, x-rays, lensing, dynamics. All of those require that there's overall maybe 6 or 7 times as more matter than you measure in the gas and the stars. Peculiar velocities and large-scale structure in the CMB tell you something about the global cosmological parameters, right? The omega matter is around 0.25, but if you add that together with the known density of baryonic matter, 4%, the ratio of this is roughly consistent with this. Okay, total matter to baryonic matter. So surprisingly, the picture hangs together amazingly well. And this wasn't the case 10 years ago. And that's, I think, what gives people a lot of confidence is that different independent methods are all pointing more or less than this. I mean, there are small disagreements, right, at the 10, 20% level, but there's no disagreement about the fact that, yes, you need some dark matter more than there are baryons, for example. Okay, so that's not debated. How exactly whether this number is 20 or 25, that is debated. Right? But that's the level that it's at the moment. Okay, so frequently asked questions. This one I've already addressed. All right. So can the dark matter be made of something dark? And I told you that omega matter is around 0.25, and what I said earlier, that Big Bang nucleosynthesis and CMB says total baryonic density has to be this. All right. So let me talk about a few other things. What is the particle's mass? We have very few constraints about this, assuming. So I've said it's nothing made of baryons, it's not a brick or a Jupiter or a planet or a black hole, at least not a, could be a primordial black hole that was created, you know, before inflation, right? But it's nothing that was made of a material that became stars and then exploded, which is the only way we know how to make black holes at the moment. So when I say it's not black holes, it means that kind of black holes are the remnants of stars. Because we know how many baryons there could have been, and we've measured it at very, very early times. The particle's mass, we don't know much about, so we're assuming now it's some kind of particle, and it's usually assumed to be a weakly interacting particle, right, because it's dark and it can't scatter light, so it can't have an E and M interaction. So it's usually assumed to be something like a neutrino, but more massive. Okay? And it can't be a neutrino, because the neutrinos are too light. We know how many neutrinos there are in the universe. And there's a limit, which I haven't had time to talk about, but there, the mass of the particle affects this spectrum, which I showed you earlier. Okay, so let me go back a few pages. So if you have a particle, if the particle which is generating the spectrum is too light, okay, like neutrino mass, for example, a few eV, then what's going to happen is that this spectrum, if you work out the you work out the propagation and the growth and the instabilities, you'll find that fluctuations on small scales are washed out, and they're basically washed out because the particle is relativistic in the early universe. Okay, so this structure that you see here wouldn't be there. This blue curve would turn over like this. Okay, so you eliminate particle, you eliminate fluctuations on small scales and be very smooth. That's already in strong contradiction with the observations, which show that the universe is quite clumsy on small scales. Okay, and that you can turn that around and turn it into some kind of limit on the particle mass, and it's in the KeV range. But it could be much more than that, and we wouldn't know. Okay, the problem is, let me go back one more time. The more this turnover will happen, right? And the more massive the particle is, the earlier it goes non-relativistic, and the smaller physical scale that corresponds to today. And so for a very massive particle, this may turn over somewhere here, but that's totally unobservable. Okay, so we only have constraints on it down to where we actually have measurements. Yeah?
Does the fact that those first data points are offset from sigma?
Yeah, it's curious, isn't it? It's curious. Could mean something, or it might just be statistical error. So what you'll have to do is ask, I think you have Pat McDonald on your speaker. Get this is a few years out of date. Ask him, is this the latest? Is this still true? I think he'll probably say it's not. And ask him if there's any evidence for neutrino mass. He'll probably talk quite a bit about the neutrino mass, I suspect. Because that's one of the good things that the small scale power spectrum that you get from this intergalactic hydrogen is very sensitive to how, you know, we know the neutrinos out there. Right now, there's only upper limits on its mass from these kind of measurements. Okay, so the dark matter particle is probably around the KeV, or much, much more, but probably not much less. We don't know too much about its interaction strength. There are some constraints on, there are different forms that it could interact, and people have posited many things. It scatters off itself, it annihilates within itself, it has some cross-section of some kind of interaction. And those are much harder to get a handle on, but there are constraints you can get from astrophysical observations which have to do with the structure of dark matter halos, which are different in the case where those particles essentially don't see each other at all, and if they scatter off of each other. And so James Taylor is sort of an expert on this, and I'm hoping he'll say a little bit more about that later on, what kind of constraints you get on those other properties. All right, so that's the last thing. My last question is this one. What about forgetting about dark matter entirely, okay, and just change gravity? All right, so we'll ditch GR, and we'll replace it with something else. I've got 5 minutes to talk about this, I guess, plus questions. And the short answer is, yeah, it's generally possible to make this work for one kind of system. Okay, so a long time ago, there was this thing called MOND, which was just modified Newtonian gravity. That's what it stands for. Okay, so it was going back to the spiral rotation curve problem. Okay, and since that's all Newtonian anyway, that's all you have to modify. Right? You modify Newtonian gravity to fit the flat rotation curves. And you can do that effectively by assuming that there's some minimal acceleration scale in the universe and cooking up a formula so that you asymptote to that acceleration. So in such a model, you can have only baryons in the center, but they have more force at large distances, right, than normal 1 over r squared. And if you do that right, you have one adjustable parameter, which is this acceleration scale, you can get very good fits to the rotation curves that are just as good as any other theories. The problem comes when you try to take that theory with the parameters that you fixed and apply it to a different system. Okay, so in the context of what we saw here, we saw galaxies, tens of kiloparsecs, clusters, a megaparsec, large-scale structure, which is, to do that properly, you have to do perturbation theory around the expanding universe, but the scales of 100 megaparsecs. They're very, very different scales. Right? And it's so far I'm not aware of any theory that has successfully modeled more than, you know, a small dynamic range in masses of systems, a factor of 10. The problem with a lot of, and then there's a further problem, is that if you really want to do everything, you really need something that's not a modification of Newtonian gravity, but you need something that's a modification of general relativity, so you can do what would the CMB fluctuations look like in that theory, what would large-scale structure growth, you know, anything where you're perturbing around the GR solution, you have to have a GR-like theory. And so, hang on a sec. In general, those systems don't work well when you try to extend. Either you can extend them because they're Newtonian, or they don't work well even if you can extend them to systems which are a little bit different. And you either have to change the parameter that you set originally, which is a bit unsatisfying, right? Or not fit it at all. Yeah?
How's it then with dark matter? I mean, you need to fine tune the temperature that you get to the right distribution along galaxies. So that's that fine tuned temperature and fine tuned cross section and so on.
I wouldn't, it's usually not considered as bad because, so you have generally one number which you fit, okay, which is the density of this stuff. You don't know anything about the particle mass. So long as the mass is bigger than a few keV, you're okay.
But it needs special temperature?
No, it doesn't need any. So it's called cold dark matter just because it's massive. So the cold really means that it's massive, and hence it has low velocities at early times compared to something like a neutrino, which is called hot dark matter, just because it's light. So it doesn't have any particular temperature spectrum. It just has whatever characteristics come out of the thermodynamics of the inner universe. So there's no tuning of a temperature. Really, all you have to assume is that there's a negligible cross section, and that the mass is bigger than keV. Okay, but once you've done that, the good thing is that you can fit this very wide array of data with it. So whether you find that satisfying or not is somewhat of a philosophical question, but I would argue it's less unsatisfying than some other alternatives. Yeah?
My impression was that one of the most compelling pieces of evidence against Mann was, or these different alternatives, was about a year ago, NASA's measurements of the collision of galaxies in the Bullitt cluster. Do you know if they've been able to explain that at all?
Okay. So. So this is a different piece of evidence, which is also is hard to fit with the modified gravity theory. Some of the proponents claim that that they can do it. I haven't been convinced myself. But in any case, let me take you through this argument and you can decide for yourself. So these are two clusters of galaxies. Okay. Running just a few minutes over, I hope that's okay. Here's the big one, lots of galaxies in it, as you can see underneath this blue stuff. Here's a small one, okay, and the small one, the belief is that the small one came through this one at a very large velocity, thousands of kilometers per second, which is a multiple of the sound speed of perturbations in the plasma. Okay, so it's supersonic, right, locally, right? And as it goes through, you see this cone effect, which is where the name comes from. It's like you've seen those stop motion pictures of the Bullitt, you know, with high speed photography with its little cone of shockwave around it. This is supposed to be the analog of that. Okay. Now the important thing here is that if the cross section of the dark matter is negligible, like a neutrino type cross section, okay, then the dark matter clumps are just going to pass right through each other. Okay. Similarly, the stars that are in the galaxies, in general, stars don't collide with other stars. Their cross section is actually very small as well, if you work it out. Okay, so stars and dark matter are collisionless, but the ionized plasma is not collisionless. It has a strong cross section. So in this picture, what happens is that pink is measured from the X-ray data. That's the ionized gas, and that's where you see this big shock. So the two clumps, which both had dark matter stars and gas, dark matter stars and gas, dark matter stars go through each other, but the gas collides. Okay, so it gets left in the middle. Okay. Now, that will be fine. No problem so far. The blue is where the mass is inferred to be from gravitational lensing. Okay. So the important thing is that the gravitational lensing mass peaks here and here, where the highest density of the galaxies is, and not here. Okay, so if you have a modified gravity theory, one thing, it better make some lensing predictions. And secondly, it has to do it in a way which makes you appear to see a lump of mass here, even though naively you would expect. So we know that the stars are negligible in mass compared to the gas, okay, by a factor of 7 or so. So all the baryonic mass is where the pink stuff is. Okay, so how do you make it, there appear to be two offset lumps from mass here by tweaking the law of gravity? It's not obvious how you do that. Yeah?
The
Yes.
Joel told me, I don't know whether I can trust him, but he told me that picture is exactly what they expect from Morpheus.
Well, we should talk about that offline. I'll just say that I'm not completely convinced. In fact, I'm far from completely convinced. But yes, people claim they do. They can fit it with modified gravity theories. I don't know how you do it, quite honestly. It's a very, his version is quite odd. It's got, you have to assume there's a center of mass, and then G varies in such a way that it somehow creates a bump. I don't know. Anyway, I read it, I looked at it, I didn't come away convinced. But that doesn't mean people don't claim that it works. So ultimately, you have to be your own judge about whether you think it's true or not. All right. So I have no homework for you. I'm sure you're disappointed. I guess if you want a copy of this talk, I'll leave it on this laptop, which is a PI's laptop, and they can distribute it to you.
Thanks, Tom.